This is a CNA podcast.
This is Heart of the Matter, and I'm Lin Su Ling. Race and multiculturalism came under the spotlight this week, with President Halimah Yacob highlighting that multiracialism in Singapore is still a work in progress, with each generation bringing different life experiences and perspectives.
In each generation, some will want to discuss sensitive issues afresh. Younger Singaporeans prefer talking about these issues more candidly and openly, which is a positive development.
Coming at the start of an opening of a new session of Parliament, two President Halimah's remarks suggest changes are afoot. What kind of racial relations do Singaporeans' youths want, and how different is it from the social compact that Singapore has today? In the studio today to talk to these issues with me are Matthew Matthews, head of the Institute for Policy Studies Social Lab, and senior research fellow who studied race relations in Singapore extensively.
Hi.
Eugene Tan, SMU law professor and politics commentator.
Thanks for having me.
And Muhammad Irshad, founder and president of the interfaith non-government organization Roses of Peace.
Hi, Su Lin. Thanks for having me here.
Much has been said, actually, about how youths see race and diversity quite differently. Do you think that's the case? And if you could explain what has changed with this younger generation of Singaporeans when it comes to understanding multiculturalism?
Our aspirations of multiculturalism have evolved in different groups of people. For those who have lived through the turbulences and the racial riots, the early uproars, the post-independence, or before that, the expectation has always been about maintaining racial peace. You've seen some of the violence, you've seen some of the antagonism. So what you want is that there is peaceful coexistence. You want people to respect each other. You want to be able to conduct your day-to-day life without problems. But subsequent generations, especially younger generations, the emphasis has been about increased inclusion. People don't want to be categorized, don't want to be boxed in, don't want to be judged by identity. The aspirations have changed.
So, Irshad, could you tell us a little bit about what young people really want? The question really is, arguably, every generation will go through this process where they come to a shared understanding of what our history is that shapes today's norms. And that's something that has happened for past cohorts of Singaporeans. What do they want? And is this very different?
Youth today want to be heard. They want to be felt. They're recognized for who they are in all aspects of their identity. And what you see globally, we can't be living in a bubble in Singapore. So what happens in America, what happens in Europe, what happens in other parts of the world invariably do affect us. And with social media, information travels and travels so fast at the tip of fingertip. So youth today are very much exposed to what's going on elsewhere in the world as well. They do have those kind of ideas that are being impressioned upon our youth in Singapore. And they also want to be empowered to have them recognized as person of color or whoever they are in terms of the racial identity or the religious identity. Ultimately, I would say they want to be heard and recognized and to be accepted for who they are.
So I just want to throw this open to everybody, but also bring in Eugene first. If you can talk a little bit about the larger forces at play, because Irshad mentioned social media, but to be honest, social media has been around for 13 years. And there's also a lot of talk about external developments, but the Arab Spring and a lot of these other developments around the world we've seen affect us for many decades or so. What is fundamentally different here?
I think life experiences of different cohorts of Singaporeans vary. That means their comfort level with discussing a hot-button sensitive issue like race and religion would vary across society. But I think one significant force, if I could put it that way, is Singaporeans' sense of a stronger national identity. To me, I think that makes them feel that we should go beyond these subnational identities like race, religion, language, and to talk about society as a whole. And I think that also speaks to their concerns about, is multiracialism the way that is practiced today? Does it result in any particular community being disadvantaged, or whether are we doing enough? In many ways, Singaporeans, as Irshad points out, we are very much influenced by what's happening around the world. What happens in America, for example, with the George Floyd killing and protests, does make Singaporeans think about some of these issues. And some of that could be driven by concerns about whether are we sleepwalking. We often pride ourselves in being a harmonious society, but does that mean that we are papering over some of the issues that perhaps we need to deal with?
I want to put a pin in that about reviewing fundamental assumptions, which is, I think, what you're trying to get at. But first, you mentioned social justice and inequality. How much of the conversation is actually one on social justice and inequality rather than race or multiculturalism even? What's your take?
I think there is a distaste for inequality, and I think we understand this. All kinds of inequality, all kinds of discrimination is something that Singaporeans have issues with. Increasingly, people are not afraid of speaking up about it. Now, in the past, it was probably easy to speak about other forms of inequality because race and religion, there was a certain kind of sensitivity attached to that, whether it's in the media, whether it's a newspaper. There was the idea that this is a very clear marker. And because the OB markers are very clear about discussing some kinds of inequalities, people tended not to speak about that or be a little careful about it. But today, I think things have changed. And I think there's been quite a bit of openness in the last few years about taking on some of those issues, confronting it clearly. So I think people have found a lot more avenue. And social media gives you a lot of options to do that. And that people are more willing to put out some of their thoughts about inequality when it comes to race issues.
But that's the thing, Matthew, because there was an IPS survey last year released in October, and it discussed how Singaporeans acknowledge that race and religion, they still have the most potential to result in suspicion, distrust, and even anger if not managed well. So I think Singaporeans seem to understand that there's a lot at stake in that. It's not just a lifting of the OB markers. Do you think that young people are too quick to pull the trigger? Because that's what we're hearing from some people as well.
In fact, younger cohorts understood the fact that if race and religion was not managed well, it could lead to violence more than anybody else. Obviously, social studies and national education have played some part to inform people about what could be possible consequences. There's also this idea that while people do recognize that it can cause some kind of fractures, then of course people also feel that there must be ways of dealing with the issue. So the same survey, we did notice that a lot of people said we need to talk more about issues and we need to have less government intervention when it comes to some areas. So this might be the attempt of younger cohorts to say, hey, we'll take some ownership over this issue and maybe we will be the ones to raise up the matter. And if nobody else is moving on this, we will be the ones who will take that.
So all of you brought up a very interesting bit about starting points. Oshad, if I can get you to weigh in here. Do you think that when young people want to discuss race and multiculturalism, that they have a sufficient appreciation of the past challenges that Singapore has faced in this? Some people are saying, look, live and let live. There are some things that really don't need to be said. Let's not push off. So where is that balance there between these two schools of thought?
Just taking a step back into the earlier conversation, Matthew and Eugene, what they weighed on, the youth today are sort of exposed. And like you said, social media have been around for 13 years. Even with the 13 years of social media presence, youth have progressively found it very difficult to talk about race and religion. The older folks are very conservative. They may not want to touch on these sensitive topics or be open about speaking about race or religion openly. But younger generations, what you're witnessing is they're more open. They're emboldened by the anonymity in social media. And they're also able to then articulate the thoughts in a way that is able to resonate with their peers. What I also are witnessing,
although right now with social media, a lot of our names are there. A lot of people screenshot these posts and then send them to the police. So anonymity really still?
I would say anonymity still exists. So it depends on the platform that they're using. Platform to platform. So Rose Up is engaged to Twitter. Twitter, there's a lot of anonymous comments going on race and religion. And it's really calling out people, very negative comments, very toxic sort of environment.
But you don't think it's about the rise of identity politics? Because a lot of young people do put their mark on it. They put their name on Twitter. They say, this is what I stand for. I want to take a stand on this.
By and large, there's two groups of people. The one that are anonymous, they just want to be trolling people. They want to be causing friction amongst different communities, etc. But there are influencers. There are people who are influential, who want to put their mark, want to put their name, and they want to be making a stand on certain issues. So you are seeing the two spectrum, and social media being social media, as much as the different platforms encouraging people to be authentic, come with their selves and bring to the table what their views are and present it as a person, an individual, not anonymous, it takes time. There's also an evolution that's happening on the social media space where people are, in fact, calling out people for just making out statements without mentioning who they are, where the statement is coming from, and what context it is.
Right, counterbalancing forces.
Absolutely.
Hopefully that's part of a thinking society as well.
Indeed.
Maybe if I can just pull Eugene and Matthew into this conversation as well. It's interesting that Ershad mentioned there are many different types of people who are thinking about these issues, youths as well. It's very difficult and you don't want to caricaturize this as well. But do you think that because race, diversity, multiculturalism, so many words for this, these are emotive issues that can cause us to use strong words sometimes when we're trying to grapple with what we're feeling. When youths do that, do you think that this needs us to look past the desire to understand these issues deeper and we tend to sort of dismiss that? Is that like a missed opportunity, I think, for important conversations that are admittedly difficult?
The whole notion of conversation and dialogue is very important. I think when we look at this particular space, it's been very much dominated by top-down discussions. The state mediates the discussions between the different groups, you know, in terms of religion, it's very much confined to the interreligious organization, for example. And social media has, in a way, made people feel that they too want to be part of the conversation. And there is a sense that, you know, we can't have these sort of top-down conversations, that the way we deal with race and religion, language, that also needs to evolve with society's comfort level. And I think this is where the challenge lies. How do we get everyone on board? How do we go on a platform or agree, you know, upon what is it that we can fruitfully discuss? And I think that's where the tussle lies, right? Because my sense is also that while young people are very engaged where the issue is concerned, there is a concern on my part that they tend to know the issues rather impressionistically. So if I give you an example, I teach a course on constitutional law in Singapore. I also teach a course on management of ethnic relations in Singapore. And you have sometimes students questioning, why do we have Article 152 of the Constitution, which provides for the Malays being recognized as the indigenous people of Singapore and for the government to support the community? I think that's something which, again, you know, people fail to understand the context in which we are in. Yes, we can have a conversation, but we need to know how we got here.
So before I see Matthew waiting to jump in at Urshad also, what was your answer to that question?
Well, my answer to the question is that, look, this Article 152 recognises the peculiarities that Singapore was in. The fact that we were once part of Malaysia, we are the only Chinese majority nation state in a Malay Muslim world, and Article 152, in many ways, you know, emphasizes the need for any government of the day to treat each community fairly. And that means, you know, recognizing any disadvantages or recognizing that each community doesn't start on the same footing. And I think that's important, right? Because there is a difference between treating each group equally and treating them equitably.
So, Matthew, I'm going to ask you to weigh in from a macro perspective. Do you see that there's a sea change of sorts? Is there some sort of a change on the horizon that's coming? What's your sense? And then Urshad, tell us a little bit about Roses of Peace. And sure, where was the turning point when you said, this is something that I want to do and make more concrete and invest effort in? Matthew?
If you look at across generations, certainly those who are younger do have a bigger appreciation about the value of multiculturalism, what it stands for. Now, I mean, people also question that. They say, well, that's theoretical, but maybe everybody says, well, long time ago, we had lots of people from other races and we're all friends today. People do cluster and all that, so may not have the same. But yet, I think in general, there's a great appreciation. We do know that at least conceptually, the notion about not being prejudiced, the importance of not being discriminatory, these are values that many of our younger cohorts are very familiar with. And I would say the great majority would want to re-socialize society as much as possible to help everybody recognize the value of some of this. And that will then also entail then that when there are places where things have been unjust, that they will stand up and speak. So, for instance, we do notice that in some of these cases that we've heard recently, not necessarily being young person, but majority race themselves have stood up for what they see as problematic behavior on minorities. And I think that's a very important matter because it shows that the issues that different communities face is appreciated by all. That's a big game changer. If the issue about multiculturalism, about integration, was only borne by the minority communities to be concerned about that, I don't think we would make the kind of progress we need to make to see the harmonious society we need to see. And I think it takes everybody. The unbridled speech is always going to be problematic. These are emotive topics. Disparaging another community is just something that is not acceptable, particularly for issues to do with when you talk about people's identity and important parts of people's identity. So there are a lot of how to do civil discourse, which people need to be willing to accept that these are very important markers if they speak it. But I think society needs to have a place to be able to speak about these things candidly, with knowing how to speak about.
So you're saying there's a change, but we need to slowly wade into the water. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. I do think that there is a change. Some people have called that we should re-examine all race policies, pull everything out, change it, pretend we can be race blind and all that. I just don't think that will happen. And that can happen and provide the kind of outcomes we need for society to move forward. We need to be conscious that there will have to be changes in many levels, and I think even in some extent on policy, but it has to be done slowly.
So Urshad, tell us, why did you start Roses of Peace, and do you think that's the kind of change that you want to see from when you started?
When we started Roses of Peace in 2012, it was born out of frustration by a group of students who wanted to do a protest at the university campus. But I was studying at SMU. I was heading the SMUA Political Association and the Islamic Business and Finance Society. And they wanted me to endorse their sit-in protests. And the protest was in response to the Charlie Hebdo incident in France, where the caricature of Prophet Muhammad was published.
Why did that have such a resonance here?
There was a strong resonance because the group of students approached me were a group of Muslim students, and they felt that their messenger of peace, the Prophet Muhammad, was vilified and portrayed in a negative light. And what they felt was the response from the media was a bit disproportionate, and it wasn't standing up for what was right. So they wanted to put across a point that he's a person who came with compassion, with mercy and peace, and they wanted to, by way of the protest, highlight that.
But so fast forward to today, where do you think we stand compared to when you started this?
So I couldn't possibly get them to protest. So instead, what we did was to take a step back, give out a rose with a greeting of peace from all the different faith leaders to show that every single peace espouses compassion, kindness, and to live in a harmonious society. So we live in Singapore, which is multicultural, which is multi-religious and multi-ethnic. And what we wanted to highlight was all the youth who were part of Roses of Peace, they were in fact passionate about maintaining and keeping the harmony. Fast forward to today, what we are seeing, we have evolved over the years from just giving out roses and engaging the public and raising awareness. We have started doing conferences, youth forums, etc., to create more safe spaces for conversations. And I still feel that, like what Matthew said, we are still wading, testing waters with many of these conversations. We're still not addressing the hard issues, and we need more of this conversation to be held at multiple levels, including the schools. Because schools are traditionally seen as a very circular ground where you don't talk about race or religion explicitly. But I feel that the youth today are very informed. The youngsters, even at a primary school level, even at a secondary level, they're very much informed of what's going on around the world. So I think we need to bring this conversation to them in a manner which is facilitated, which is managed, and which is constructive.
So that's very interesting, because you mentioned the roles of school. Is it really schools that should be responsible for shaping these multicultural instincts? Because education has been burdened with a lot of these new responsibilities, and maybe rightly so. What to take, Matthew and Eugene, on this? Whose role is it? Is it parents? Is it education systems? Government?
I see it as a multi-stakeholder effort. Families are really the first schools. Many of our stereotypes or conceptions of race, of a particular group, may come through our family upbringing. And by that, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that parents are racist or anything, right? Because they too are shaped by their own life experiences. This is something where I think we can't foist everything onto the school, right? Because race, religion is a lived reality. People need to engage with this sort of issues, you know, form their own perspectives, know what their non-negotiables. And I think if we say that, well, schools have that responsibility, then I think, you know, schools are, I think, overburdened. They should play a part in reinforcing the importance of multiracialism. This is something that all of us have a part to play in speaking out against discrimination, in trying to ensure that we ourselves practice non-discrimination as well.
I see you nodding your head, Matthew.
To a great extent, I agree with Eugene. I do believe that families need to play a part, and no question about it. But yet I do think that some issues like racial harmony, multiracialism, religiosity, these are issues that are of national concern. And sometimes families do not do right, do not teach their children for a variety of reasons, poor experiences. And so we do have to find places within society. And I think schools are an important area where some of that education can go on. That's been the case. I do know that I have kids in school, and I do know that there's a lot more emphasis on talking about some of those issues. I think there's been a growing comfort, though I do realize that it's not always easy. There are important steps. Schools need to be empowered to be able to have those conversations without parents always writing in and saying that, you know, this touching subject, they're too sensitive. That's always the pushback, right? Teachers feel that if they raise issues or they talk about some of these areas, there might be the pushback.
But it is also very hard, because under MOE, there's actually a program called the Character and Citizenship Education Curriculum. There have been like key criticisms leveled on it. I think it's also because it was developed with a certain point in time where harmony was emphasized as almost uniformity, and maintaining relations and sort of not stirring the pot was the focus. Mm-hmm. Do you also sense the challenge is that is shifting? We're moving away from a philosophy of maximizing common spaces and giving more space to the expression of individual or even community individualism and expressions. What's your take?
Harmony has been very dominant, if I could say even domineering, right? So the idea that anything is going to upset race relations, interfaith relations, we should stay away from it.
Yeah, we're quite skittish about it.
Yes, and I think that's
but rightly so.
It depends on what's the issue, what is at stake, you know, but we shouldn't paint, you know, anything to do with race and religion as being something that only the experts can go in, you know, is confined to the academic circles or to the political elites, the religious elites. We need to move beyond that. And so if you see Racial Harmony Day in our schools, that's one where I would say, at least based on what I see and what I know, we need to remove what I call the exoticization of race, right? You know, where people come in their different racial costumes and put up this show of harmony. Now, that's important. But we must remember that harmony is built on a platform, a foundation of understanding and not just tolerance. So hopefully schools can nudge our young to think deeper about these issues, give them the sort of guardrails, the signposts, you know, by which, you know, they can engage with these issues. You know, so it's not just about sharing your opinion, but also understanding where we are, where are we heading, who we are. Because I think we need to have a more holistic understanding and not just, we should all say more about this particular issue. The big question is
how. So we need to
level
up to, like, you know, primary school to secondary school sort of understanding about race and multiculturalism.
Yes. So that level of understanding, of maturity, of insights must grow.
So then the question actually is, on the one hand, people say that this is an inevitable part of a maturing democracy when it comes to aspiring to be inclusive, that is positive and should be embraced, this whole conversation about race and diversity. But then there are some people who say it's still has to be viewed with a lot of caution because sensitivities are very real. And once you open that lamp, the genie cannot be put back in. Where do you each stand on where we are right now? Where do you lean towards?
There's no question that the areas continue to be sensitive for a variety of reasons. I mean, just geography and what goes on all over the world. These are sensitive issues. One, I do think that Singaporeans have a little bit more confidence that others who listen to their thoughts and concerns can have a certain amount of balance. Recently, we had a slew of police reports and all that. But I think a lot of Singaporeans do know that they shouldn't be handling every single issue to do with race as a matter of, I mean, of something that police need to get involved in, right? The general public has a
position. Don't everything call police, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know what the police can do for us, but okay.
At least in people's minds, at least some people's mind, this is really an enforcement model. So, I mean, we treasure racial harmony so much. Everything we treasure, let the government take care of it and let them enforce it accordingly.
Like what Eugene said, like top-down, right?
Top-down, very top-down thing.
I think as much as we're top-down, there's also a lot of scope for a bottom-up approach. I mean, Rose of Peace, we fundamentally were born out as a ground-up initiative. In 2012, the word ground-up wasn't as well-used or well-known as it is now. But over the years, I've seen a gradual shift in many youth movement organizations coming up, talking about these issues and talking about it in creative ways of engaging the youth as well. When I talk about it openly or treat it as a very sensitive topic, it is very sensitive and it is very combustible, but it has to be managed in a way, because if you don't manage it, then you're going to face with other problems of the conversations happening which cannot be controlled at all. So I think what we need to do as part of a maturing democracy or a country, we need to talk about race, that's for sure. And we need to do so in a manner which is respectful. So first is level of awareness, then understanding of each other's differences and commonalities, and then appreciating them. So we have to mature in that process. There can always be more done on this issue. As much as it is a top-down thing, I think the top has recognized that there's a lot of avenue for the bottom-up to come up and to play a crucial role in shaping this narrative.
So let me try to close off now with one or two more last questions. Very quickly, help us understand. On the one hand, you know, Singapore's multiculturalism has very often been upheld as a pillar of strength. And even IPS's survey show 2018 that interracial trust had been on the rise compared to 5 years ago. And even President Halimah Yacob said that that's something that we should be celebrating. But yet, suddenly it sounds like it's an area of contention, or at least it's an area that it's worth improving in. Where do we stand? How would you score us on our multiculturalism?
Multiculturalism has definitely improved over the years, and you do definitely see that. You look at our surveys, you definitely look at areas and we see the increase. But the same survey also showed areas of gap. It showed, for instance, that more minorities perceive workplace discrimination. With everything else doing better, harmonious ties, greater trust, less prejudice, you see this area being an issue. So essentially, people are a little bit more attuned to the issue about inequality.
Mm.
So we are doing very well in many areas. This is one area that I think is important to tackle. issues to do with discrimination at work, for instance. We have done that. We've put ourselves on a very, very good level.
Yeah, so we are in a good position. Nothing's perfect. And so attitudes like discriminatory views towards certain groups, I think that's something that needs to be dealt with rather decisively. I think there are segments of Singaporean society who feel that, you know, we can be post-racial. I'm a bit more skeptical because I think identities will persist. You think about even, you know, mixed marriages, people born of these marriages and often ask themselves, you know, who am I? But I think what is important is that even as we seek to aspire towards being a post-racial society, what we can do now really is to adopt post-racial attitudes and values. That's how we get to a situation in which race becomes a less prominent feature of our society. We define by our shared identities, you know, rather than whether you're Chinese, Malay, Indian, or others. This is something that we need to move towards. There's this view that, you know, if we remove our CMIO classification from identity cards, you know, we'll all be post-racial straight away. I think it's important to recognize that if we do that, I think the minorities might actually be concerned because they will ask whether in a Chinese majority Singapore, does it mean that now our identity, our place as minorities is no longer valued. We need to tread carefully, but certainly, you know, get into that conversation and do it the right way. So the how question matters a lot.
It's a work in progress, like what Madam Halima said. Over the years, we have seen, like what Matthew mentioned by way of the survey, there's tremendous improvement. You know, more people are willing to talk about it, more people are willing to engage, more people are willing to share their own personal stories, etc. But as we move along, what we are seeing is the conversation getting deeper and deeper. Because once there's a certain level of comfort with the level of discourse, then invariably the community, the people would then want to delve deeper into the discourse and to have sharper dialogues. That's exactly what I feel it's being played out and it's happening.
You've totally set me up for my last question, which is it's really good to have good conversations and conversations that percolate towards these issues that need spotlight on. But what is one concrete change that you would expect out of this? And as Parliament sits again on Monday, and a lot of talk has been about how there will be concrete changes and shifts. Can you each name one top change that you'd like to see and one thing that you'd like to keep the same when it comes to this?
I'd really like to see some work done on issues to do with workplace matters. The idea is that we don't have a situation where everybody is discriminatory, but there is a portion who feel that way. And so I think it's important for some clear policies to be able to deal with that.
Does TAFEP not deal with it decisively already?
TAFEP works on people complaining, people writing in complaining about the fact that they've been discriminated. Not many people are able to do that, willing to do that, because they, for one, find it very hard to make that case, trying to find exact reasons why you make that allegation, right? I think there are many other areas, for instance, looking at issues to do with when there are barriers about language, for instance, and maybe that language is not totally necessary for the operation of the job. Some of those policy needs to kick in to be able to stop some practices.
When I shared earlier about schools, schools has a crucial part to play in shaping the views of our youngsters. There are schools which have done so very well. Nanyang Girls High School, you've got Dunman High School, which has been very active on interfaith issues and so on. These are best practices and models that I feel that every other school should look into and adopt it. These are important matters that concerns our country moving forward.
What are they doing there?
For example, Dunman High sends their students to participate in the conversations organized by Southeast CDC on open conversations on race, on religion, on things like that. And Nanyang Girls High, they've always had a focus on interfaith on conferences. They host them, they have conversations on interfaith relations and etc. These are just two examples, but I'm sure there are many schools that are already doing such things. But how can these be highlighted? How can these programs be embedded into the curriculum of sorts? Or maybe not even curriculum, they have 2 hours of national education every week. Can this be part of some programs for the students beyond just the learning journeys to the various places of worship? These are important avenues for us to educate our young and youth and giving them space to speak about them, to articulate their thoughts. And, you know, not just drown in their own echo chambers. And then they can also hear from other people. This is an important avenue for us to also connect people from, say, for example, schools which may not necessarily have the diversity of race and religion, to also interact and mingle with other schools. So there are pilot programs where the madrasa students and the SAP schools, they do work together, they do interact and get to know each other and so on. So we have to find ways by design how we can bring younger people from different backgrounds together to really understand one another and to appreciate each other's tradition, faith and background.
Eugene, take us home.
I would like to see us constantly evolving our sense of multiracialism. I don't think it is a static concept. I think it's something that must be lived. And I think that's where it's important for each of us to recognize the role that we play, whether it's in terms of trying to deal with discrimination at work, trying to correct people within our own circles, prejudices or stereotypes. This is one where each of us have a role to play. But I think what's important for us is to remember that there will always be this persistence of identities. But the challenge for Singapore, for any society that wants to be multiracial in a very vibrant way, is how do you rise above these narrow identities? And I think that's where we need to focus on what is it that binds us, what is our shared identity, and what are the shared values that will ensure that our shared identity remains one that is cogent, one that continues to inspire us, and one that all of us would want to further protect and grow.
Right, so throwing the ball back to Singaporeans to own this, really. Okay.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you very much. Well, there you have it. Is Singapore at a turning point in our race relations and how we approach multiculturalism? I'd ask you to watch the news as Parliament sits again on Monday. That was Eugene Tan, Matthew Matthews, and Mohammed Irshad. You've been listening to Heart of the Matter with Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer, working hard behind the scenes. And I'm Lin Su Ling, signing off.